Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. I think my name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined today for our annual discussion of 24 Hours of Horror, The Massacre, by JB.
And you never guessed that we had been up a really long time. We stayed up past our bedtime. We've been up and up and up and up, and you know we're all just on vacation.
Happy Scary Movie Month, everyone. Scary Movie Month continues at fthismovie.net. Make sure every time you watch a horror movie in October, you go to fthismovie.net and participate in the Scary Movie Challenge. You leave a 7-word review. We read them on the show. Not this week, obviously, because we have a lot of other stuff to talk about. And as is our way, we typically skip the Scary Movie Challenge section on these massacre podcasts. This is our fourth or fifth massacre podcast.
Podcast, I do not know.
I think it might be our fifth.
Massacre, I do not
yeah,
know.
Yeah, right. Now I know it's more than we've been podcasting. But hey, if you're new to the show, go to fthismovie.net. That's our website. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at fthismovie. You can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com or find us in the iTunes store. Just search F This Movie. If you like the show and you want to leave us a nice review, that would be great. We appreciate everybody that has taken the time to do that. Or you can listen to us on Stitcher if people are into Stitcher.
Or you can stalk us illegally, and then later that will be made into a film based on a true story, just like The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Who is going to play you?
I've had a lot of people tell me that I remind them of Paul Giamatti.
Okay. I'm going to be a young Emma Stone.
She's got the crazy eyes.
Not before she was old and washed up. So we're going to talk about all 24 hours of our respective horror marathons. At one point, they intersect.
Yes, we have a new feature for
people. We like to change it up every year.
When worlds collide, that something's going to happen, and during this podcast, your reality is going to get fucked up.
So we used to go to the same 24-hour horror marathon.
Back in the good old days. And can I wax nostalgic?
Sure.
This is certainly a case of don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. Because in the old days, we had no idea how good we had it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try not to nitpick this year because there's a lot of nitpicks. But it really makes you wish they had just done it the way they used to do it. And this is weird because I used to get there at like 5 in the morning.
Yeah.
Because there was a seat that I needed to save. And now there's no reason to do that anymore. In fact, it made it seem less massacre-y that I could just drive up, park, walk in. Adam was there. How you doing? They were showing trailers for the first hour, which was fun. But before we start, can I get up on a soapbox for a minute?
Please do. I have one. Right. It's right behind
here,
you. It's right
here,
behind
here,
you. Okay. There it is.
Okay. I'm getting on the soapbox. And now I'm turning myself inside out. Now I'm all inside out. We are guaranteed life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so far, the life and the liberty are okay. But this whole pursuit of happiness thing. On Saturday, I drove to the Portage Theater for The Massacre. And at this point, I know this is an elderly guy mouthing off. But it took forever. And then last night, driving here took forever. And then this morning, maybe because everyone's at church or asleep, I'm not exaggerating for effect. Because I time myself 15 minutes door to door.
Wow.
As more and more people drive, shouldn't our leaders make adjustments to the infrastructure? Because this isn't just me wanting to get to a movie on time. This is people going places to spend money to stimulate the economy. Or is this part of a master conspiratorial plan where we get everyone to say, well, let's just stay home?
Yeah.
Are you kidding? No, let's just stay home to sort of turn us into sheep. The commute is getting to be bad.
Yeah.
and get off my lawn.
We used to go to the same 24-hour marathon. Then a few years ago, there was a split. Now there are two 24-hour marathons in Chicago.
One in the loveliest theater. It's just a joy to go there. It's the happiest place on earth. But their lineup was, and this isn't just
not
me,
as strong. No, I would agree with that.
That we were counting on some people from F This Movie going, but at the last minute, everyone decided to stay home. And then we just finished the official massacre,
right?
The massacre that's always been the massacre.
At the Portage Theater,
and
which has had some trouble in the last year.
And just for people in the Chicago area, we got to the Portage yesterday, and there has been controversy and trouble, as there is with every large theater, and they have removed the first 10 rows of seats. So now you literally can't sit in the front row, as friend of the website Paul Stone prefers, and stare straight up at the screen, because they have so many live music shows there now, they've effectively created a dance floor.
But they did remove the speakers that they had sort of hastily put up that were blocking the screen, correct?
Right, and they actually had those down in front of the stage right by the mighty Wurlitzer Theater organ, and it wasn't a problem, and I was really, it was sort of kudos to them for taking care of that.
Yeah.
Because the first film was a silent film, and they did accompany it live, which
That's
is
cool.
always
right.
a treat. Jay Warren on the mighty Wurlitzer Theater organ. So my massacre began with the Lon Chaney film The Unknown.
Which I have never seen.
So it is unknown. And I think it's not in anyone's top 10 because, you know, he's not a monster and it's not irreconcilably. Oh, my mouth is turning itself inside out. Theater of the mind. It's in your mind. But it's a wonderful film because it is directed by Todd Browning, who directed the Bela Lugosi Dracula. And once again, we have the problem of hipster douchebags.
Mm.
And especially in the case of this film. And is it okay if I spoil a 90-year-old film?
Sure.
That the same thing happened that as when we were watching the when Roger Ebert showed for the Alloy Orchestra silent film. It's on the tip of my tongue. It's the Douglas Fairbanks film that's in two-strip Technicolor.
And the Black Pirate?
Yes.
Okay.
That he showed the Black Pirate, and everyone was, oh, we're so much hipper than this now. But what they don't realize is that that film was made tongue-in-cheek, as is parts of The Unknown. Lon Chaney is an armless man. So once again, we get Chaney's incredible ability to affect change on himself. And I guess he used some sort of corset that tightly bound his arms to his sides, and he plays Alonzo the Armless, a circus performer who throws knives with his feet.
Wow.
And he likes throwing knives at the circus owner's daughter, who is cuter than a button and played by Joan Crawford in what had to be one of her first parts,
right,
and she looks like she's 16. And the daughter has this problem with men because she doesn't like to be touched. She doesn't like to be touched. Lon Chaney has no arms or hands. I think I see something brewing here.
Mm-hmm.
The strong man.
Always. Always the strong man.
Loves her. But he has arms and hands.
Yeah.
Strong arms that she can't stand. So Chaney believes that she will fall in love with him. And he takes steps to drive the strong man away. And then it is revealed that the Chaney character actually has arms, but he's hiding them.
Oh.
Not only has he committed many murders, and so there's the fingerprint thing, but he has an unusual condition where he has two thumbs. I know what you're saying. JB, I have two thumbs. No, he has two thumbs on one hand.
Got
it. He has a double thumb.
Got it.
So the minute the double thumb shows up, it's policemen and sirens, and he gets taken away. He decides that if he's truly going to pursue this 16-year-old Joan Crawford, that's going to be a problem because, as his buddy says, on your wedding night, she'll discover you have arms. So he, the friend, is really good at thinking down the road. So Lon Chaney blackmails a doctor into amputating his arms.
Holy cow.
Did I tell you this was Todd Browning? And he gets back from recovery. He is now truly armless, and he returns to discover that in his absence, she has gotten over her fear of being touched.
Oh, irony!
And she's now in love with the strong man. And when Chaney hears the news, it's the highlight of the film. His face is in this frozen mask of, what have I done? And he begins to laugh. He begins to laugh hysterically. And the audience is going with it because this is good stuff. I mean, this is the reason we're there. And then Browning has Joan Crawford say the line, which is subtitled because it's silent. Alonzo is laughing because he's so happy at this situation, which is really sort of grinding your nose in the irony.
Yeah.
And I think Browning knew what he was doing. I mean, he's deliberately overstating the case.
Okay.
So, once again, you're laughing at nothing. If you haven't seen The Unknown, you should. It's only about an hour long, but of course, now you don't have to.
It's a lot of plot for an hour. That's impressive.
Well, that's strange that you say that, because it isn't enough plot.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I just summarized it in 2.5 minutes.
Oh, that's true.
It's a film that seems long, but again, Chaney is the berries.
And how was the print? One of the advantages of The Massacre is that he oftentimes will show prints, although, again, I know having to change venues every couple of years affects what kind of a setup he has to show, they have to show film.
And I guess when the Portage was going through its troubles, the people who had the original projection equipment up there, which was the Chicago Film Society and some other private people, they took all their stuff out, including a brand new video projector. It seems to be The Massacre this year was schizophrenically going back and forth between 16mm, which was problematic. I think they were prints from private collectors. And I applaud him waving the flag of celluloid and trying to show film. But then the other half were on video. Stunning video. When I came back this morning to Twins of Evil, it was like, oh, my God. And it's what I said years ago when I first saw digital projection at the Music Box. I went to the holiday show to see White Christmas, and I was like, oh, if this is what it's going to look, okay, you've won. So as much as they find this cachet in film, real film, celluloid, it's a problem because the 16mm projector they had didn't have the brightness that was necessary, and that's an easy – you get a light meter and you go up to the screen, and it should be a certain number. But people – and by people, I mean our friends and former students, kept coming up to me during the Haunted Palace and saying, what's with this? And I haven't been able to go home and spin the disc yet, but it seems like maybe it was a 16mm print, what they used to call a television print.
Okay.
That a long time ago, televisions actually had a run of film print that they were basically videotaping off a screen to show it on television. And it either looked oddly cropped or that the projectionist wasn't using the right aperture gate or that the film had been pan and scanned for television. At the very beginning, Vincent Price and his wife encounter a tavern.
Right.
And it's the Burning Man Tavern. What director would frame that shot so that half of the sign wasn't in the shot?
Right.
So that was our first clue. And then every time there were shots of people walking from one end of the screen to the next, which happens a lot in the Haunted Palace, there would kind of be this jump where they were repositioned on the screen.
Okay.
Like the telescene operator wasn't very good at doing pan and scan. Well, this is for TV. It was odd. So I applaud the fact that they want to use film, but if the last 24 hours are the results, the proof is in the pudding.
Yeah.
I'd say we need to stick with video.
Mm.
The town that dreaded sundown was just, it's glaucoma vision, and it's not just me.
Yeah.
Because that had an additional problem. Not only were they showing it on film, but they were showing it with a widescreen lens, a spherical lens.
Okay.
And way back when, I used to monkey with those at the high school when I would do a film day.
Right.
and you got to get it just right. And the image, like, skews, like you're drunk, and you have to get it to be the perfect rectangle because it's the lens that's unsqueezing it.
Right.
Then you have to focus it.
Okay.
And then you have to go back to the squeezing.
Right.
And then and it's like cracking a safe.
Wow.
Town That Dreaded Sundown, and I'm not trying to nitpick because I appreciate the fact they were trying to show film. Town That Dreaded Sundown was out of focus.
Hmm. That's a bummer. That's oddly funny you mentioned that movie. That's the first thing I watched.
But you watched the remake.
But I watched the 2014 remake.
And that's what I want to talk about because I haven't seen the remake.
Okay.
But you've seen the original.
I have.
Okay. What is your opinion of the original?
I don't love it.
Nor do I.
No.
Is it fine?
I think it's interesting. I think it does some things that other horror movies don't do. I think the killer is kind of scary, obviously was an influence on like the Friday the 13th series.
Very definitely.
Part two. I kind of like the sort of documentary approach they take to parts of it. I think certain scenes work really well, and then I think those scenes are sort of butting up against these weird comedy bits where the police are cross-dressing and they're kind of bumbling fools.
That was my comment because I don't think I've seen it since 76.
Yeah.
And I still remember the first time I saw it was in a drive-in. And I remember the advertising campaign better than I remember the film, but I'm not sure if they know that they're making a horror film. And
okay.
I think we watch it during the massacre and we're sort of drawn to the horror parts because there are. But it seems like whenever they get close to making a horror film, they reel back, and now suddenly it's this documentary that's
right.
based on this true story that they're
right.
kind of doing a Bonnie and Clyde thing. I applaud the fact that they're doing a period film on a low budget in 76. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the film takes place in 1946.
Mm-hmm.
So I applaud that. But just like you said, once it starts being something, it can't continue to be that.
Yeah.
And then at the end, you get that American Graffiti thing.
Right.
Where now we know what happened to all those people. I know the audience at the massacre today, who had never seen it, were really let down by the ending.
Okay.
But in a way, that's one of the things I like the best
yeah,
about it.
Yeah.
Because very few films, I wouldn't say courage, but
right.
very few films are willing to do that. Notice I'm not spoiling The Town That Dreaded Sundown. So what does the remake do?
So the remake exists now in a world where those murders happened in the 40s. And then in 1976, they made a movie out of it called The Town That Dreaded Sundown. And now everyone in Texarkana, like every year, possibly every more, gets together and watches The Town That Dreaded Sundown. Charles B. Pierce's son, Charles B. Pierce Jr., is a character in the movie, not played by the actual Charles B. Pierce. He's played by Dennis O'Hare from True Blood and Michael Clayton. Even though that guy exists and is alive, he's a character in the movie who sort of consults on what might be happening. So this town still watches this movie, and then a new phantom killer appears. It seems to be copying those same murders and what's going on, and we have to find out who it is, and is this a real phantom killer? Is this a copycat? There's a lot that I really liked about the movie. It's like it's made by, and I don't have the director offhand, Ryan Murphy, who's a TV guy. He produces like Glee and American Horror Story, is a producer on the movie. And I believe it's pretty much the whole crew from American Horror Story who made the movie, including a director who directs a bunch of American Horror Story, a show that I've still never seen.
Neither have I.
The movie is good and sometimes very good. Too often up its own ass with style. The filmmaker seems very concerned that if he isn't doing some sort of trick in any given scene, you're going to lose interest. He's not going to justify his job. I don't really know why he decides. And I like a lot of that to a point. I mean, I'm a big Brian De Palma fan. To a point. And then there's a certain point where it does nothing but call attention to itself as a movie. It does a weird thing where every once in a while it'll flash to scenes of them in 76 recreating this thing from 46. Like, you'll see a murder in the movie in 2014. Then the camera starts to pull back and you'll see the aftermath of that same murder being recreated by a film crew in 1976, recreating something from 1946. And I wish a lot of that paid off in a more interesting way. Sometimes it's just like, oh yeah, they made a movie out of this and isn't this fun? I don't know how much of it got kind of cut up. I know, I think there was some behind the scenes stuff and some studio meddling that maybe got rid of some of that that was more interesting, because I don't even know why any of it survived. If it's the kind of thing where there either needs to be more of it or none of it.
You can see a certain type of studio saying, what is this?
Yeah, but somehow some of it remains, and so you're like, oh, what is this going to be interesting? No, just we're going to forget it? Okay, cool.
I think it's interesting that you say that that the new one has this sort of surplus of style. Because if anything, the original has no style. It is one of the most unimaginatively shot films I've ever seen.
Yeah. This one has kind of a better sense of pacing. I mean, that's one of my issues with the original, is that it's more just like, and here's some stuff that happened. There's no real through line.
Film Crit Hulk says, it calls ant pacing.
Yeah.
And then this.
Right.
And then they went here. And then they did this. It's interesting you bring up, though, that the remake tries to be meta.
Yes.
Because one of the things I like best about the original was one of the last scenes in the original is the town coming out to see the movie that you're watching.
Right.
And that's delightful.
And they kind of jumped off from there, it seems. I mean, the very first shot in the movie is basically this huge aerial shot that comes in over the town. It's the drive-in screen watching the original, and then it swoops over the drive-in screen and follows every main character. It's this huge, you know, five-minute tracking shot. Again, very technically impressive. But that style doesn't always really inform the narrative at all. It's just style for its own sake. But I think, you know, kind of worth seeing, and not getting a theatrical release at all, which is crazy. It's available, I think, like on VOD and iTunes. I saw it on iTunes. I think it's the kind of movie that would look great in a theater. I think it's, you know, much more cinematic, for better and for worse, than a lot of horror that does get theatrically released. So disappointing that it can only be seen at home, but worth your time.
I'm wondering if they did some target marketing research and discovered that the only people who have warm feelings about the original are people my age who aren't
maybe
really known for going out and seeking things.
It's not a super well-known
at movie theater
title.
Next up at the Portage was The Haunted Palace, which was effectively ruined for me because, was that last year?
Yeah.
It seemed mighty fresh.
Yeah.
Last year, was that Scary Movie Night?
No, that was just us here watching movies.
Was that in March?
No, that was in October.
And it wasn't scary?
Nope.
Patrick showed a whole bunch of us The Haunted Palace.
I think that was just me and you at that point. I think it was one of those where everybody was kind of coming and going, and it was just you and I, and I think my daughter watching The Haunted Palace.
You know what? That part I remember, because she was doing a delightful dance.
Yeah.
But not
and
only
a pretty good Vincent Price impression.
Only she was doing Egghead, which isn't my favorite character. I was just about to do an impression of your daughter doing an impression of Vincent Price doing Egghead. I think none of us need to hear that. That not only was it spoiled for me because it was so fresh in my mind, but you were showing the new Scream Factory Blu-ray, which is beautiful, and unfortunately, we were watching it at the Portage, not only on 16mm, but I believe it was an experiment in projecting it through an aquarium for fun. But again, even though it wasn't optimal conditions, it really showed what we were talking about 2 weeks ago. Vincent Price movies, specifically the Roger Corman Vincent Price movies, are so much fun.
Yeah.
You could sit there and ignore the characters and just say, I like the set.
Right.
I like the costume.
Right.
And, of course, he gives a marvelous performance, actually doing kind of a pit in the pendulum thing, because his character starts as this crazy demonic witchcraft guy, gets burned, and then he's his own great-grandson. And he starts out normal, and then he goes to the dark side. So it's that whole Jekyll and Hyde Price thing.
That's every Vincent Price Corman movie either. It's about him going crazy or him believing that, like, his lost spouse is crazy or returned or a witch or a demon or a ghost.
And that's part of the fun. And 2 weeks ago we were talking about The Tingler, and if you think about it, even though that's not the plot of The Tingler, it's like that's why they threw in the LSD scene. Because in every movie, Price gets to go bonkers. It's in his contract.
We mentioned it on the Vincent Price show that we did, and that's not my favorite of the Roger Corman, Vincent Price.
You mean Haunted Palace?
Yeah.
No, not at all.
It's not my favorite. Still would be fun to see in a theater, so it's unfortunate that a lot of those movies I think would be great in a theater. I mean, they're very much sort of widescreen focused, but again, it sounds like not the best projection experience might have taken away from some of that.
And this week in class, I have this new class I'm teaching called Contemporary American Texts. And we started a unit on film noir, and I was telling them a little bit about Elijah Cook Jr. and Marie Windsor, who seemed to show up in every film noir ever made. And I'm watching The Haunted Palace, and lo and behold, there's Elijah Cook Jr. He's in everything.
Yeah.
He's like Ward Bond in the 40s.
Next, I watched The Uninvited from 44. Does that sound right?
Mm-hmm.
This was my first viewing of that movie. The Criterion Blu-ray of that movie. So it looked really great, and the photography in the film is very gorgeous. A lot of interesting stuff with lighting and shadows. I did not love the movie. It seemed to never want you to take it very seriously. It was this weird, almost like what you were saying about The Town That Dreaded Sundown, where every time it was like, oh, we're going to deal with a ghost that might have returned, and this past tragedy that happened, it would sort of retreat back, and the score would become kind of upbeat and silly. Ray Milland, it never feels like really commits. I don't know. He seems weirdly standoffish for the whole movie. I like Ruth Hussey. Is that who that is?
Oh, the
She's his sister.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's in the Philadelphia Story. And I'm just a fan of her. So it's good. I haven't seen her in a ton of stuff because I think she did a lot of TV mostly. And then I won't spoil the ending, but we kind of get to the end and it's all sort of shrugged off as a joke.
Well, and the part of that is The Uninvited is one of the many not in name only film versions of Turn of the Screw.
Right.
And I know I've had many, many students, for many, many reasons, read Turn of the Screw at my suggestion, and they like it. It's more of a short story than a book, but uniformly, unilaterally, unanimously, they really hate the ending.
Okay.
And I won't spoil the ending, but what you're identifying about the film is very much based on what it comes from. Driving home last night from your house, I finally put this together. The Uninvited does show up in some books and some people's lists as maybe not one of their favorite horror films, but one of those horror films that's very good at suggestion.
Okay.
And from a very young age, I think I thought I saw The Uninvited, but I hadn't. So here's what I finally figured out. Every time I read about The Uninvited, every time I thought I saw The Uninvited, I was thinking of The Haunting.
Oh, okay.
And I have seen The Uninvited.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there was a time when I thought The Uninvited was The Haunting.
Right.
Like when I was 12. And that carried over. And I was like, oh, Uninvited, it's the greatest thing ever. Well, no. The Haunting is the greatest thing ever.
Yeah.
The Uninvited is okay.
Right. I recently just saw The Innocents for the first time. And that's another movie that is obviously very good at suggestion.
Thank you. And that's... It's even more complicated than what I just said.
Yeah.
I confused the three.
Okay.
I confused the three.
Two
of
those I think are good at suggestion. I don't think The Uninvited is great at suggestion.
And I believe The Uninvited and The Innocents. Wait a minute. The Uninvited and The Innocents are both based on Turn of the Screw.
The Innocents definitely. The Innocents definitely is.
Okay. Because it's, right?
Yeah.
Here's what I think. I think my tragic confusion was even worse than I thought, because there was innocence love being
right.
thrown in there.
Right, right, right.
So could it be that I've never seen The Uninvited?
It could be.
But the minute you say Ray Milland,
yeah,
I think I've seen it.
Okay.
This is bound to be very interesting to our listeners. Well, there's an old man, and he went on
it's
and
on. It's one of these movies that you end up seeing because, you know, I put it in there, A, because I had the disc from Criterion. I had never watched it, so it was an excuse to see it. And because I just didn't want to spin another Universal monster movie that I've seen four or five times, I was like, well, I can watch something new that's, you know, a ghost story and kind of a classic. But it wasn't as good as a Universal monster movie.
And that's one thing. I wouldn't say I would fault The Massacre, but one thing I missed, because usually we'd get one.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe – I think this might be the 13th or the 14th Massacre.
Holy cow.
It's at least the 12th.
Okay.
And so maybe they kind of ran out of the classic ones because there's only 8 of the classic ones really.
Yeah, but you could still show. I mean, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, or one year they showed.
Well, I think Toy John has
Old Dark House. I mean, they're, you know, they.
I think, or Cat in the Canary. One year they show Cat
yeah,
in the Canary.
Right.
I think Toy John, who used to do shows at the Portage, has a lock on Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, because without exaggerating, I've seen Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman at least 5 times at the Portage. I could draw you the opening credits.
The original title was Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman Eventually, right? I like that movie. Don't get me wrong.
For those of you who have never seen it, for those of you unaware of the controversy, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman started out a very different film, and it was messed with.
Right.
And the extent to which they messed with it actually gives us the popular conception of Frankenstein as this brute that walks around with his arms outstretched. I won't get into it, but check out the DVD or the Blu-ray. There's a wonderful little documentary that will explain to you why that happened. Next up at the Massacre was Targets.
Okay.
Which I haven't seen in a dog's age. It's been a really long time since I've seen Targets.
Yeah.
And several times, the highlight of the Massacre this year for me was what it's supposed to be, seeing these things with a big, appreciative audience, because Targets is so much better than it has any right to
right,
be.
Right.
Corman still had Karloff under contract for a couple days. Peter Bogdanovich was looking to make his mark. It was shot very fast on a very low budget. But again, as friend of the site Paul Stone said, we were discussing Targets during the 3-minute intermission that followed Targets. Massacre people, longer intermissions,
yeah.
Please. Turn on the lights. Targets is so remarkably prescient. You watch it, and except for the clothes and the cars, you're like, well, nothing has changed in the last 40 years, and it's disturbing. Karloff gives one of the best performances of his life, essentially playing himself months before he passed away. A theme of the film is that his character has become typecast and no one wants to come and see him play a normal person. And the irony is that here in Targets, he's playing a normal person that one suspects was pretty close to him. He's kind of cranky about things. Wonderfully shot, really cleverly written. There's a whole bunch of things where I'm sitting there thinking, this could have really gone off the track so easily. But that it was like through sheer force of will, Bogdanovich, who wrote and directed it, said, no, I'm not going to make a crappy film.
Right,
I'm not going
right.
to make this cheesy cash-in. That this is actually going to have something to say about a whole bunch of things. It's so good. If you haven't seen it, I recommend it.
I just saw it for the first time last year or the year before, I think during Scary Movie Month, and like you, was sort of impressed at how contemporary it still feels. And it's kind of horror adjacent. I mean, it's not directly a horror movie. I think the thing that really pushes it over is this idea that Karloff is playing this old horror actor. I mean, there's, you know, horror obviously in the situation of, hey, this sniper is taking people out, but plenty of movies have been made about something similar, and we don't call those horror movies. But the fact that Boris Karloff is involved and is playing a horror actor makes it the kind of thing you can get away with showing at a massacre.
Although, at one point, I don't think I'm spoiling anything, the sniper is literally inside the drive-in screen. And when we were discussing it afterwards, I wondered, can you imagine when the film came out, seeing it at a drive-in?
Right.
You drive away. You'd leave.
Yeah.
I mean, that would really be unnerving.
Yeah.
Mm. So that was a coup, and that was a wonderful thing for them to show.
Yeah, and that's really cool, because I think I'll bet that a lot of the audience was exposed to that movie for the first time, and that becomes the Spider Baby or whatever, the one that you come away with saying, I didn't know anything about that movie, and holy shit, it's good.
The year that The Massacre showed Bucket of Blood, I got that feeling.
Yeah.
That no one had seen it. Yeah. And it's like, this is so light and funny and hip and kind of self-aware.
Yeah.
And I don't have a perfect finger on the pulse, but my feeling was in the theater, this is less than 24 hours ago, the majority of people hadn't seen it.
Yeah. Yeah, we're recording this, just so you guys know, right after we've been awake for more than 24 hours watching nonstop horror movies. So.
And Patrick is doing a devil of a job hiding his tired voice. And I don't have a tired voice, because if I told you how much coffee I've had in the last 5 hours, I could get up out of this chair, run around outside your house 10 times, and come back and sit down. Though I won't.
sort of by accident, I didn't necessarily plan it this way, but I, too, watched a late-period Karloff movie for my next movie, which was Die, Monster, Die, an American International Pictures release with Boris Karloff that I also didn't love.
And was that the new Blu-ray?
It's Scream Factory, yeah. Again, I sort of used...
It just came out.
A couple months ago, maybe. Yeah, I sort of used this as an excuse. One of the things I didn't... like, literally slave over programming anything. I was just like, well, I need to see this and this and this, and I haven't watched this yet. So that was sort of how I put things together. And it's a weird release for Scream Factory, because aside from the Vincent Price collection and a handful of others, I mean, they tend to focus on more, like, 80s and 90s stuff.
Definitely.
So Die, Monster, Die is sort of an anomaly in their catalog. Again, just because I like... that period, I like the look and the feel of those old AIP movies. It's very colorful. Boris Karloff is in it, and he's fun to watch. But the movie itself is just not that good, I didn't think. Are you a fan?
No, I've never been a fan. And if anything...
I'm looking up the lead actor's name right now, because I didn't like him at all.
If anything, Targets really shows... Karloff prided himself on being a working actor. And at the end of his career... he took pretty much everything he was offered, and you can't blame him for that. But talk about an opportunity wasted. I remember reading that two of his final films were films that he made in Spain or somewhere, or Italy. I'm confusing the story, but he was literally on oxygen in a wheelchair, and he would get up and do a scene and then sit back down in his chair. And I give him so much credit for that, but maybe they could have put him in better movies if he was making that sacrifice to be on set. Because we were just talking 2 weeks ago about Comedy of Terrors.
Yeah.
And he's delightful in that.
Yeah,
he knows exactly what movie he's in.
Yeah.
And around that time, he's in a beach party movie as this art collector. And he's...
Everyone was at that point in a beach party movie. Nick Adams is the lead actor's name, which doesn't sound like his birth name. That sounds like his actor name.
No, Nick Adams. He might have taken it. There's a bunch of short stories by Hemingway called the Nick Adams stories. But Nick Adams is in Rebel Without a Cause as one of the... juvenile delinquents.
Right.
And then in the 60s, he is in every low-budget Spanish co-production, Italian co-production. He's like the American.
Okay. That's what he is in this movie,
too. They're using as, oh, Nick Adams is in it. It's in a, like to fool people or something, or to get backing.
Right.
But boy, Nick Adams has made some shit.
And just can't carry a movie. I don't know. I mean, you're just sitting around waiting for Karloff to show back up. And then in the last 15...
It's what we always say about Brad Pitt. He's a supporting actor. He should have
done not a particularly interesting one, I would argue.
He's good in Rebel.
Sure. In the last maybe 10 or 15 minutes, Die, Monster, Die gets kind of crazy with glowing green rocks and... Karloff transforming into this weird metalhead thing. Not a metalhead, like long hair and earrings. But yeah, I did not love the movie.
And then we have another 2 minute break. And at the Portage, we come to one of the things I was most looking forward to, because I believe I was 12, which means I was in seventh grade, but I remember being younger than this. Listeners, there didn't used to be quite as much media. There was a lot less stuff. So, for instance, if you watched a TV show on Sunday night, there was a real good chance that the kids at school had seen it too, because there were fewer stations. And I so well remember the next day after Trilogy of Terror was on TV for the first time, that's all anybody was talking about. And if and the kids who missed it, well, we don't know if it will ever be on again, because we don't know that there's a future in these things. It's Dan Curtis, who was the guy behind Dark Shadows, and he took three Richard Matheson short stories, had William F. Nolan adapt two of them. Those are the first two, and they're sort of EC Comics gothic, and they're fine. I mean, they're just – they're fine. It's in fact, if you want to see, this is what was on television in the 70s. It's very typical. And then the third segment, which I'm guessing most of you have seen, is one of the scariest things that's ever been on TV. Because really, Stephen King talked about this in his book Dance Macabre. They don't want you to be scary on television.
Right.
They're afraid people will turn it off or switch to another station. It gets in the way of the commercials. You are not allowed to be too scary. That may have changed. But the Trilogy of Terror, the third sequence, it's become something of a tradition. I show it in all my classes on Halloween. We take a day off of extensive English grammar, and I show that for fun. And every year it gets the same reaction. They chuckle because it's so old. Ooh, buildings don't look like that anymore, and clothing styles have changed. And I swear to you, every year, halfway through, they're...
Yeah.
It's so good. It's so clever. And I have to think, that's the one that Matheson adapted himself.
Yeah.
So I think that has something to do with it.
Sure.
It's a model, not only of direction, it's directed really well, but it's a model of things coming up at the beginning that don't call attention to themselves and then paying off
right.
at the end.
Right.
And I don't just mean that she's calling her mother and that becomes a thing. I'm talking about little things about where everything is in the apartment. It's so good.
I need to revisit it. It's been a long time.
I have it on regular DVD.
Yeah.
In fact, this made me wonder if I let someone borrow it, so now I got to get it back in time for Halloween. Karen Black buys her boyfriend a Zuni warrior doll. And then all hell breaks loose.
That seems like the kind of movie that Scream Factory would be putting out. I'm surprised that they – I mean, I'm sure it's a rights issue. I'm sure they've looked into it, but that seems right up their alley.
And even the DVD looks a little drab and faded, although that could have been assembly line television production
right.
in the 70s.
Right.
I would really like to see that look better.
And I'm assuming they were showing that digitally.
No.
Really?
It looked like film to me.
Wow.
Which, again, I didn't have a chance to talk to anyone, but a lot of it looked like 16 millimeter.
Okay.
And, it was fine.
Yeah.
It didn't get in the way.
Yeah.
In fact, right before it started, a young lady sat down behind me, and I thought her reaction was really interesting because, again, she was laughing
yeah.
out loud in the first 5 minutes. And by the middle of it, she was screaming at the screen.
Yeah.
For really, it's so good.
That's great. Next for me was the original Prom Night. So I was not having nearly as much fun as you. It had been a really long time since I had seen the original Prom Night. And it's been put out on DVD countless number of times. I don't know what the deal is. It's not a public domain movie, but yet it ends up on all of these shitty DVDs. Here's 12 horror movies for $8.
The company
and one of them is Prom Night.
The company and the company probably went bust. The library keeps getting sold.
Yeah.
And full disclosure, I've never seen it.
Yeah, you're fine.
I remember, I think it came out when I was in college. And I was not seeing everything that came out. And I lumped that in with Terror Train.
Which is another movie that the popularity of which I don't understand. There's things I like in Terror Train. It seems like there's a couple of slasher movies that come out right after Halloween that Jamie Lee Curtis makes that now are considered sort of classics, I'm assuming because Jamie Lee Curtis is in them.
But I think there's another reason, too. And I think it might be the reason why I continue to not see them, because I lump them in with the cash-ins. I've never seen Prom Night, and I've never seen Terror Train. Perhaps, even from a young age, I felt so burned by Friday the 13th, I decided to forego all of the...
Yeah.
Happy birthday to me.
So, right. So Prom Night is now out on Blu-ray from Synapse, and it looks great. It looks better than it ever has, and that was really the reason to watch it. But I will say this. A phone call came in for me right before Prom Night that I had to take. So I had the movie in, and the menu was playing on repeat while I was finishing this phone call. And the menu is a dance number from late in the film, Jamie Lee Curtis and her date doing this disco dance, because this is the disco slasher movie. The theme is a disco song. It's all very disco related. So it's just on this constant loop, her and her date dancing. I would say buy the Blu-ray, watch the menu a few times, and then take it out and put it away, because that's the best thing in the movie. And I watched it. Not just because Jamie Lee Curtis is pretty great looking, but also it made me wish that she had made more movies where she danced, because it was really just this and Perfect. Is that right?
That was pretty much my reaction to Roller Boogie. That you know, Linda Blair. Let's get on those. Put on your boogie shoes,
right,
Linda.
Right. It's just a totally generic horror movie. Leslie Nielsen shows up for two scenes, maybe, even though he's top billed.
And, of course, the Leslie Nielsen conundrum is that...
You can only watch him as Frank Drebin now.
That the minute he was in those Naked Gun films, I think there's people who watch Forbidden Planet now and, wait for him to fart.
Mike arrived during Prom Night, I think, and was commenting, like, I can only see him as Frank Drebin. I said, yeah, I can watch Forbidden Planet, mostly for Anne Francis, but also because he looks different enough. He's young enough that I can handle Leslie Nielsen in this kind of serious role. In Prom Night, he's silver-haired Frank Drebin, and I can't think of anything else.
It's a good thing he drowns fictitiously, because he's the captain in the original Poseidon Adventure. Yeah. So he's dispatched pretty early, because every time they go to him at the wheel, it's like, I am serious, and don't call me Shirley. You keep waiting for that to spring
from
his mouth.
So Prom Night is very generic and has a ridiculous twist. And I don't – unless you're sort of an aficionado of early 80s or even late 70s slashers, I just can't think – I don't know why it's considered a classic. It should not be. Big sigh.
Such a ringing endorsement.
Yeah.
I do not want to buy your Blu-ray. At this point – the massacre became an hour to 90 minutes of shorts, which is usually my favorite part, because for the last couple of years, he's challenged people to make trailers in the style of hysterical 1950s AIP trailers. And the good news is there were a couple people who did that, including one group that is consistently represented, and theirs are head and shoulders above the best, and it's nearly professional. In fact, the team that won, the director came up to accept his prize, because it was a competition, and admitted that what we had just seen, they had filmed last weekend.
Holy cow.
And he had edited this week, that he lives in L.A. now, but he flew back to Chicago because he wanted to enter something in the massacre.
That's cool.
And without spoiling it, because I'm guessing it's on YouTube, it's a group called Low Carb Comedy, who I believe were the geniuses behind last year's Werewolf on the Moon.
Okay.
Because on the moon, it's always a full moon. that their entry this year was Galilaikan. And it's about Galileo becoming a werewolf. And... And the premise is funny, but the execution is even funnier because it involves the Pope and their conception of the Pope, and the actor who plays him is one of the funniest things I've seen in a long time and leads to the punchline of the whole thing. If you can possibly can, I have no idea how it's spelled, but it's Galilaikan.
I like it.
And then, and I promise that before Patrick posts this, I will find the URL. The other short that made life worthwhile, there is an indie band. I don't know their name. They recorded a song. I don't know its name. But if you love horror films, the people who made this obviously did it very lovingly. It's about a town where it's all the monsters. All the monsters we love live in this town. And the music video is like this little film where we get to see them interact. Patrick will post
it. I will, yeah.
And when you clickety-click to start the podcast, it'll be there. And I want to give these people credit because it doesn't look low budget. It looks like they spent some money. And obviously, I've never heard the band, but it was a highlight. And Dave the Rock Nelson, local legend, who makes these little independent horror films, actually had an entry that they couldn't get to spin. So we missed out slash were spared that one because the Samsung menu on the screen indicated that, as opposed to the other shorts that were about 3.5 minutes each, his was 28 minutes.
Yikes.
Oh, and before I forget, before the shorts, they did one of their fundraisers for Vital Bridges, and someone came up because they had the winning bid, and I think this is a first for the massacre, or it might be a second. The gentleman proposed to his girlfriend.
Yeah, Adam Risky was texting me about that.
And he was really great.
That's
and
cool.
As is usually the case in these situations, thank God she said yes. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
But it was really sweet, and everyone was congratulating.
That happened once at that Full Moon Roadshow that we went 2 years ago.
That's right.
The writer of that Evil Bong movie was on stage and proposed to his girlfriend, and she said yes. But all of it, like so much of that day and that movie in particular, fell flat. Like, I didn't feel anything. I wasn't happy for them. I was just like, please get off the stage.
And I think that's what I was thinking of in terms of a previous one.
Yeah.
But this was the opposite.
Right. That's great.
And he actually had a little speech that was the proper length.
Sure.
But it was basically, you're the only one in my life who will share these movies with me.
That's great.
And you tolerate my Klaus Kinski obsession. Will you marry me? And she started crying.
Wow. Well, that's nice.
And she said yes, and they hugged. And wow.
Yeah. That's cool.
That's terrific. That was right another highlight of the massacre.
All right. So at this point, I put on the 1990 remake of Night of the Living Dead.
And then
you are in a car.
And then Patrick gets a text, we're on our way.
Yeah.
And then he sends me a text, who is we? Because really, if I wanted to be a practical joker, there were about 20 people at the massacre that I know, former students and friends and things. Hey, we're all going to Bromley. But it was just me and my lovely wife. And, of course, things transpired between driving and the procurement of food and the making of peanut butter brownies and the necessity for showers, that literally I got here an hour and a half later than I originally intended.
Okay.
But how much of – we didn't really miss very much.
Not very much. No, I don't think so.
It was like the first 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So that was great. So this is where worlds collide.
Yeah.
Instead of taking a break from the massacre, it's out of the frying pan and into Patrick Bromley's personal fire. And by personal fire, I mean his lap.
Yeah, it was nice. So now our weird two split massacres have joined. I haven't seen the Night of the Living Dead remake in a long time. I did not love it when I saw it, watching it this time. And I felt like watching it again because hearing the guy from Twilight Time on Killer POV, I wanted to see it again. And so then I was looking into trying to find a Blu-ray of it. And, of course, it sold out. They only made 3,000. And he said that when they made the Blu-ray, that the transfer that Sony did, you know, Twilight Time doesn't do their own HD transfers. Sony doesn't. In out of respect for, I believe, the director of photography's wishes, sort of tinted some of the early scenes. They're a little bit bluer and darker. I guess he wanted it to not be so bright during that early, that graveyard scene. and the movie comes out and people lose their shit because it looks different than the way they've seen it all those other times.
Even though those
even
other
though
times,
they're trying to say,
we're not, you know,
hey, we're trying to get it right. So people lose their shit. People are returning it, although not very many. He said they offered anybody who doesn't want it can return it for a full refund. He said like 9 of them came back.
And those 9 promptly went to eBay where they right. captured high price.
So so he says they're never going to put it out again because now they're re-releasing some of their titles that sold out. They're putting Fright Night out again. They might put out Christine again.
But not that. Once bitten, twice shy,
but not
baby.
That way. He basically says, why would we want to put up with that shit again? Because we're not going to do a new HD transfer. It's going to be the same one.
Horror fans are the worst.
So we're not doing it again. So that's it. Those 3,000, that's it. And I really wanted one, so I'm looking on eBay, and it's anywhere from, you know, $50 to $100, and I'm just not going to do it. So I put on the DVD, and the movie is fine. Like, I feel like it should be better or worse than it is. Tom Savini directs it, does a fine job. For a movie directed by Tom Savini, it's very low on gore or violence.
Yeah.
It's pretty tame. The makeup, obviously, is more elaborate on the zombies. It's written by George Romero.
The violence and the profanity are so low
yeah.
that when someone does swear, mm-hmm. it takes you back like you're mm-hmm. watching commercial television. I regard the remake as, let's say you're into ballet.
Okay.
And there's a ballet that you love. Let's call it Swan Lake. And you've seen it. Downtown Chicago, professional ballet company, and it is your favorite ballet, and you know every second of the ballet, and you have seen it done the best it will ever be done. And then you go to a community theater production of it, because I think I can speak for both of us. We have seen Night of the Living Dead so many times, we know it backwards and forwards. So what becomes for me is the variation on a theme where Romero chose to make some changes, most notably in the character of Barbara. But also, I noticed last night, an interesting structural change. In the original, Ben takes the dining room table apart and does most of the boarding up, delivering a monologue to Barbara before we discover there's anyone else in the house. And now Romero has moved that to later in the film where the other people can help Ben and cement the fact that there's one group trying to do one thing mm-hmm. and there's another group trying to do another. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, there are some changes that are interesting. Barbara, as we had commented last night, becomes much more the focus of this movie. Ben is – spoilers for both the original and the remake coming up. Ben does not survive the night and step outside only to be gunned down by police. He is shot inside the house and turns into a zombie. And Barbara becomes sort of the lead, and she's very much in sort of the Ellen Ripley tradition.
Definitely.
And, I mean, I sort of understand some of it because, you know, having a black man as the hero maybe isn't as transgressive now as it was in the 60s, and so in order to try to do something different, they make a woman the hero.
And I showed the original in class for 30 years, and young people have no patience yeah. for Barbara yeah. in the 68 version. No patience for that shit whatsoever.
But it's a very weird remake in that they change some things and then leave other things very much the same. So during the whole scene where they're trying to get out with the truck, and they get to the gas pump and the truck explodes. It's like, this all plays out pretty much exactly the way. So why, again, it's like either change more or less. And I don't necessarily want them to change less because then it becomes Gus Van Sant's Psycho.
But it's weird because it doesn't want to do fan service.
Right.
And at the same time, it does. So
the little shot of the trowel on the wall.
Well, that was my example.
Yeah.
That's a very famous scene.
Right.
And when the little girl bites her mother in this version, it's almost like Romero was saying, no, I remember the trowel.
Right.
I remember the trowel.
Right.
I directed the original.
Right.
But also, before we even got there, my wife was saying that one famous line. And even though there's a lot less of the posse in the remake yeah. than there is in the original, we get the camera going by. And we
right.
get to hear him say that one
right.
line because
right.
you have to have that
right.
line in the movie.
And again, then Barbara says, we're them, they're us, which has become textbook. I joke about it all the time. Doug now jokes about it because he hears me joke about it, where it's just this movie more than once has Barbara exist to just deliver the subtext. So at one point when everybody's acting crazy, she says, "This is madness." Like, no, we know. And we're them, they're us is so embarrassingly on the nose. You did miss the opening scene with Bill Moseley as Barbara's brother. And they do a nice little bit of misdirection there where you see the figure approaching from way in the back and he finally arrives and it's actually just like kind of a kooky old dude. It's not a zombie. And they're like, oh, he goes, oh, sorry. And he kind of walks away. And just as he walks out of frame, bam, the zombie hits him. So that was kind of neat and sets you up for like, well, this isn't going to quite be what the original was. We're going to change some things. But then a lot of it is pretty similar.
This isn't your daddy's Dead Living Dead.
Except now Barbara commits murder.
Except when it is.
Right. So not a waste of time. An interesting experiment. But it's one of those movies that you think should be better because of its pedigree, I guess.
And the other thing I wanted to add about the Night of the Living Dead remake is that it really made me appreciate the original Ben and the original Harry.
Yeah.
Because one thing I don't like about the remake, Tom Towles, as much as I might like him as an actor, he seems to be in a different movie.
Okay.
A funnier movie.
Oh, okay.
It's really big and it's really broad, and yeah, we don't wind up hating him as much as we hate the original Harry. Also, I think Tom Towles should always have a mustache, as I pointed out last night.
And then, you were still here. So whatever was next for both of us.
Oh, you're still here.
We don't have to do the back and forth game. So next was Exorcist 3?
Yes.
Okay. Which I had never seen.
Which is what makes this interesting.
I liked a lot of it. I actually was really on board with it. And then I think the last 10 or 15 minutes...
Last 15 minutes where the script pages are a different color.
And this was something that...
And they smell different.
That comes up several times during this experiment, that endings suck. I thought the last 10 or 15 minutes were bad and out of a very different movie, which it turns out they were, because they were basically reshot to have a bigger... They needed an exorcism at the end because it's The Exorcist, so... They rewrite, they invent this priest character to show up and do an exorcism, and the stuff at George C. Scott's family's house is not handled well. So the last 15 minutes or so kind of lost me. But up until then, I actually thought it was really strong.
And the first time I saw it, I liked it a lot better than I liked it last night.
Okay.
And I had pointed out to you and Mike that I had read the book, and the book is really interesting because I didn't feel it was William Peter Blatty cashing in. It was him exploring a theme that he was actually on the record saying he wished the original Exorcist film had explored a little bit more, that one of the reasons why we might delight if we have proof of evil is that by negation it might prove that there's also good, which is very – it's not even subtext. It's very explicit in Exorcist 3 because the book is called Legion. But if you can imagine a movie that doesn't have the pyrotechnics at the end, doesn't have the exorcism at the end, doesn't have Nicole Williamson at all, and doesn't even have Brad Dourif, has...
Was it all originally Jason Miller?
I don't know.
Okay.
But
I was trying to find something about it and couldn't.
It's weird when it switches back and forth, isn't it?
Yeah.
And again, Dourif, who I like, has been directed... to be so much the in-your-face, defiant serial killer,
right.
I keep thinking it would have worked better if it was a little bit more matter-of-fact, if a lot of it was George C. Scott and Jason Miller engaged in this philosophical discussion of evil. But, of course, we can't have an American film that's about that, so we need to have all this stuff. The scariest scene... which our Mike has written about, still worked in spades. I mean, I don't know if it's the editing or the music sting or something. But watching it last night, I realized it's also misdirection. That shot down the hallway goes on.
Well, that's what I was noticing because I knew what was coming because I had read the thing that Mike wrote. And so as soon as we get that long shot down the hallway.
But it takes.
I was amazed at how long. They were holding it.
That might be.
And they hit you with a jump scare before that one.
Oh, yeah.
She goes in the room and the guy pops up and says, hey, I'm trying to sleep.
And he's the cat. He's, right. He's right. The misdirect.
Right. I honestly, and I didn't jump in because I knew it was coming, but I very closely observing the moment and sort of steeling myself in preparation for it. When it happens, the camera also kind of zooms in real quick. I think the zoom steps on the scare. It's stupid, but I think it does.
Because my memory did not include the zoom.
Yeah.
It just, there's suddenly this figure.
Right, right.
Very intent yeah. on what it's doing.
Yeah, and it's scary. I just I liked George C. Scott so much, and I liked his performance so much. He has a scene where he's talking about the original Gemini murders with, is it just doctors? I think it's just doctors. It's like the head of the hospital who's chewing him out, and I never could get a handle on the Scott Wilson character, but maybe you can shed some light on that for me. There's that weird scene where he's rehearsing what he's going to say.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really pay off. I don't know why he was rehearsing what he was going to say.
That some of
Maybe Scott, I missed something.
I always assume that some of Scott Wilson's stuff got cut.
Okay.
Because in the film we watched last night, he exists as a paper victim.
Right.
Almost the minute he shows up, you're like, he doesn't make it to the
right. end. Right. Okay. So he has the scene where he's talking about it, and in the middle of telling them about it, he starts to break down, and he's crying, and he's like, oh, I'm sorry, and he pulls himself. I've never seen that in a movie before, and I was so sort of moved by that. This cop who still carries this with him to the point where just talking about it, he starts to break down.
And having read books about real cops, that happens all the time.
Sure.
So do American filmmakers think – we'll sit there in the audience and say, wussy.
Yeah.
It seems like that should be included more often because they are required to witness horrific things.
Right. It just, none of his family stuff works. And when it gets to the end, that's supposed to be this big moment. But it's a family that we barely know exists. Had he not told the story about the carp in the bathtub, his family doesn't, he doesn't need the family. He's in the hospital the whole movie.
And because Kinderman is elderly, in both versions, and might even seem kind of older in The Exorcist, and there's no mention of his family in the original except for, my wife doesn't like going to the movies with me. Do you want to come to the movies?
Yeah.
It's sort of weird that he has this family.
Yeah. Yeah. None of that stuff works. But there was a lot of stuff I liked in the movie. Next up was Magic, which I had also never seen. A lot of this was first-time viewings. I didn't realize was directed by Richard Attenborough until his name came up in the credits. I remember that William Goldman had written it. Didn't know much about the movie, except that it involved Anthony Hopkins and a puppet.
And it was a big deal when it came out, because it was really one of the first times, even before Silence of the Lambs, where this was a respectable horror movie.
Right.
And it was based on a novel that was a bestseller. And it had these actors who you have seen before. Also, it had a TV commercial that was really creepy. And as I told you guys last night, I still remember going on opening night. And back then, that movie played the audience like a symphony, because I don't think, except for the original Halloween, I've ever seen a horror movie audience.
And that's wild, because watching it last night, I didn't think there was that much that was even sort of intended to be scary.
They kept waiting for the puppet to move by itself.
Okay.
And my memory of it was that there was one moment where that happens, but watching it again last night,
yeah,
there isn't. There's one moment where you think, okay, this is where they're doing it. But in the reality of the film, the puppet is not moving by itself.
It's not?
It's when Ed Lauder.
Yeah.
Because, can we spoil
this? We're going to spoil Magic, everyone. Whatever.
Anthony Hopkins is standing behind Fats.
Okay.
Because, obviously, he's the one who's doing.
Right.
It's Anthony Hopkins behind the knife. It's not.
Right, right.
But for about 2 minutes, we think the fucking thing turns its head by itself, which back when I saw it is what the audience was waiting an hour and a half for.
Right.
And they lost their shit.
Right. At watching it last night, I think I read the scene as, because they never come out and say that it's Anthony Hopkins, right? You just sort of say, like, oh, no, he was the one doing it.
Because of what happens 2 minutes later.
Right. So that the movie just never quite answers the question of exactly what's going on, which I liked. I don't know. I was on board with the movie for a lot of it. It's another movie that I think in its last 30 seconds makes a disastrous decision. Disastrous. And that's a hard thing to do. If you fuck up the last minutes of your movie, that's how we remember your movie. We walk away with that bad taste in our mouths.
And Patrick said last night, we get music. We have the camera tracking back in the cabin.
Yes.
I believe this is over. last night, Jan said that she absolutely loved much more than, again, when we get the dummy saying, you idiot, it was always you, which was dumb.
Right. We're them, they're us.
But what Jan really liked was when Fats said, I hope I don't go first.
Yeah.
Which is chilling.
Yeah. I liked the movie a lot. I think the ending was sucky. Again, just from talking about the last 30 seconds, the stuff that happens after what should be the ending. But I really liked the movie.
There are things to like, including what things looked like back then and the clothes people wore. At one point, Anne Margaret is packing a suitcase, and it contains 17 brown sweaters. And I even noticed, once they get to the cabin, I think the director of cinematography was definitely not stopping things down, but there's a color palette that the film uses where there are no bright colors. Mm-hmm. And I think that was deliberate. I don't think that's just that assembly line TV bad lighting. There was an attempt to make it look not washed out, but not clownish.
Right.
That there's a color aesthetic going on.
Right. I had some issues with the Burgess Meredith performance, but the scene where he sits across from Anthony Hopkins and says, I want you to not do the voice for 5 minutes. That's a great scene. I think it plays a little fast and loose with time because 3 minutes will go by and they'll say, not a minute.
A little bit, but I thought that was another reason why that was interesting is that real time is different than movie time.
Right.
And at least in theory, that's when the film slows down and tries to approximate real time, which is excruciating if you're watching a movie.
Yeah.
I love the beginning of that scene where we see that Burgess Meredith is at the doorway, and I think he says something like, you've got a really big problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not the line.
No.
But it's nice that the film is willing to not do the dance at that point.
Right.
To just have him say,
right,
I have seen something massively fucked up,
right,
and now we will proceed from that reality.
Right. Yeah. It was good. I liked it. And then you left.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I'm just one man. And I needed to sleep for 3 hours.
And I stayed up and watched The Bird with the Crystal Plumage for the first time. It's a Dario Argento movie that I have never seen, and I subscribe to the massacre adage, the massacre belief that in the middle of the night you watch Italian horror. This is not the usual kind of Italian horror that has been shown at massacres in the past.
I thought you would be watching something by Fulci.
Right, but I've kind of burned through a lot of those, so I was trying to see something that I had never seen before. It's very much, it's a much more, I would say, sort of accessible Argento film.
Yeah.
It lacks some of the craziness. But again, and maybe it was the fact that I was watching it at 3 a.m. alone, very tired. I didn't have a ton of patience for it. I've gotten much better about enjoying a lot of these weird Italian horror films, and I actually was sitting there wishing this one would get weirder. It was playing it too safe for me. But it's interesting to watch it as his first film because you can see a lot of the things that will come up again and again in his later, arguably better movies.
Arguably better. I thought for sure you were going to spin some Fulci.
No.
And then after Bird with Crystal Plumage, I'm either sleeping or waking up. I woke up at exactly the same time I wake up for school.
Okay.
And what are you watching after Bird with Crystal Plumage?
I lost track of time, but overnight is rough because I programmed some crap.
So did you sleep at all?
There were two movies coming up that I nodded off a couple of times. But
please note, this is acceptable as when I got back to the portage, the entire audience was asleep.
Yeah, right. I think most people just assume that at some point you have to sleep, and I'm a crazy person, and so.
In fact, the guy in front of me, two rows in front of me, slept through the entirety of the last three movies.
Wow. All right.
Which, that's tough in a movie theater.
Let me ask you this, because I read some things on Twitter that I found interesting. Was there heat in the building? More than one, well, one person specifically that I was following talked about how freezing cold it was, especially overnight.
It was freezing cold. And the reason I knew this is because I am never cold. I have a coat that I can't take off. And so I'm wearing a hoodie and I'm freezing. And this is yesterday at like 4. So I talked to someone who was with the show, and that person assured me that it was just me.
No, but it wasn't just you.
When I drove back this morning at about 7, it was 36 degrees outside.
Right.
And when I got back in the theater, when Twins of Evil ended, I approached my former students who do the whole 24-hour thing,
yeah,
and they were fit to be tied. One of them was saying, well, next year we got to bring blankets and stuff. And this poor young lady who was one of my former students was just teeth chattering.
That's miserable.
It was not warm enough.
Okay.
Although, would you agree that because it's impossible to get the right temperature in a movie theater, if you're going to air, this might be the chicken or the egg.
Right. Yeah, you don't want it
too
to be
too hot. Is problematic, too. Although, at 36 degrees outside,
exactly,
you can just step outside.
Right. You can't have people.
What else did you read on Twitter?
For 24 hours.
And who was Twittering about it?
Just somebody that one thing was that women were not allowed to put paper products in the toilets in the washroom. So there was a sign up that said, no paper in toilets, please. So there were some things going on that every once in a while. I really wanted to go this year for a handful of reasons. And ultimately, I just knew that I couldn't sit in the seat for 24 hours. And because I believe that I have to do the whole 24 hours, if I go, I said, no, I'll just stay here and do 24 hours. But then these things would pop up and I was like, well, I probably made the right call. I made the right call.
Because when I was there, I kept debating about whether to text you with tidbits,
right,
so that you could feel like you were there.
Sure.
And I just ultimately decided, except for one or two things, that that would be a distraction from your movie.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Next up for me was Deadly Friend, the Wes Craven movie from 1986. You know, Wes Craven doesn't have a lot of good movies. He's got a handful that I really like.
That's not the made-for-TV one, is it?
No, but it might as well have been.
Okay.
It feels very... No, you're thinking of Deadly Blessing? No. That was theatrical, wasn't it? Deadly Blessing might have been made-for-TV. That's the Amish one with Ernest Borgnine. Was that made-for-TV?
He's got one that was made-for-TV.
Yeah, I don't think it's Deadly Blessing. I think that was theatrical. Deadly Friend is a kid makes a robot, and Christy Swanson lives next door, and her dad beats her up, and he essentially kills her. So he pushes her down some stairs, and she's brain dead. So he puts the robot brain in her.
This sounds like Frankenhooker.
It sort of is. And so then she walks around with a little bit of, like, gray makeup under her eyes and twitching, and she starts murdering people.
And does she say, want a date?
She doesn't, no.
Want a date?
She throws a basketball at Anne Ramsey's head until it explodes, which is sort of the one thing in the movie that everyone remembers.
I think that's the one scene I've seen.
It's the thing that anybody talks about, because the movie is not very good. It's interesting to watch Wes Craven sort of try to do a young adult movie, you know, except for the basketball head and maybe one other thing. It's pretty tame. Like, it could just be almost a PG movie.
There was talk of naming the film Basketball Head.
But it's not very good, and another movie that has an ending and then goes on for 2 more minutes that is disastrous and a horrible the worst 2 minutes of the movie are at the very end. And so it ended, and I just thought, well, fuck you. And now it's 6 a.m. and I'm very tired, and I put on, don't ask why, Witchboard 2, The Devil's Doorway. Again, I'm just a believer that overnight you put crap on. That way, if you do fall asleep, which I did for part of Witchboard 2.
You miss nothing.
Exactly. I'm not a big fan of the original Witchboard. Maybe because I could care less about Ouija boards.
At Flashback, Adam was daring me to watch Witchboard.
The original?
Yes.
It's an interesting little time capsule because it does deal with Ouija boards and Tawny Katane is the lead, and so it's this 80s time capsule. Oh, at one point we were scared of Ouija boards, and Tawny Katane is in the movie, and she represents the 80s.
I thought you were going to say at one point in the 80s we were scared of Tawny Katane.
Well, we're scared of Tawny Katane now. So the original, while not very good, has a little bit of that value. Witchboard 2 was made in the 90s. Amy Dolenz is the lead, and not a particularly gifted actress. It's just not a very good movie. Again, I nodded off for probably 20 minutes of this, so maybe that's not fair for me to make this assessment. I did not love it. I did not love Witchboard 2, The Devil's Doorway.
And at this point, JB is out of the shower and fresh as a daisy, and he's actually experiencing the scariest part of the massacre, that if I can get to the Portage in 15 minutes at 7 a.m. on a Sunday morning, what would my life be like if I could get to the Portage Theater in 15 minutes any other time of any other day?
Yeah.
This weekend, I have spent way too much time in the car. But thanks to running late and the massacre running late, I get there just in time for Twins of Evil. And
which I've never seen.
It's interesting.
Okay.
Not completely successful, but again, much like my very first podcast, now unavailable, going for hundreds of dollars on eBay, I can't think of another Hammer film where every pore of this movie exudes Hammerness.
Okay.
And even though it is not good, you're willing to watch it and enjoy it because you get to walk around Hammerville.
Right.
So the gimmick is the Collinson twins, who I believe after this movie were the first set of twins in Playboy.
Okay.
That they are twins for real. And they are twins in the movie.
Okay.
Madeline and Frida. And they are apparently twins of evil. And so the first 20 minutes is stultifying. It is just stultifying. And the only thing to keep your attention is the sets and the costumes.
Yeah.
Because they're something. And then, and remember, half the audience is asleep. Peter Cushing arrives on the screen. And someone literally said, "At last!" Because the minute Peter Cushing shows up as this crazy sort of Quaker vampire hunter guy who's in charge of this, these men who have, it's nonsense. He shows up as a vampire hunter, so to speak. You're instantly involved in the film. And then, because this is that period of time where Hammer's not quite sure what kind of films they want to make, they're basically teasing you with nudity for an hour. Now, back up a little bit.
Like a little bit of Peter Cushing's leg.
I'm slap happy. Horror fans are not attractive. We are soft, doughy, overweight creatures.
Okay.
Some of us have personality defects and hygiene problems. So maybe the stereotype is correct.
Mm-hmm.
But Patrick, I wish you had been at the massacre this year for this one transcendent moment. After teasing us for an hour, one of the Collinson twins.
Just one?
Gives it up.
Okay.
And from the other side of the theater, I can't possibly replicate, because the key to the joke was his voice.
Okay.
From the other side of the theater, I hear the saddest, loneliest horror nerd. And it was a mixture of frustration and utter happiness and maybe sleepiness.
Yeah.
One of the Collinson twins gets nude. Pause. At last! He shouted that.
Yikes.
in the theater.
Yikes.
Okay, we see what you're here for.
Yeah.
It's mostly interesting, for being sort of generic Hammer. It's worth your time,
okay,
but only for Cushing.
Okay.
Did he ever give a boring performance?
No, probably not.
And he's not showy.
Right, right.
I remember reading somewhere, I think it might be in his autobiography, that he loved props, that he always wanted to have a prop, especially if he had a long speech. And now that informs my viewing of all of his films,
right,
because he really does use those to his advantage and in all sorts of very interesting ways. It's no Vampire Lovers.
Sure. Few movies are.
But Patrick, Twins of Evil, at last.
So I've only got, I think, two more. So it's morning for me. This year I could have squeezed in. I watched 12 movies. I could have squeezed in a 13th, I think. But I was allowing myself a little bit more time in between. Some for just, you know, adult responsibilities.
And because of sleep, shower, and travel, I got to see 10.
Yeah. So then I saw Final Exam, another just generic fucking slasher movie from the early 80s, 80 or 81. It's, again, not, this was my first viewing. Not really good. I'm a fan of the 80s slasher movie, or at least a student of the 80s slasher movie. This one is not very good. And in fact, in so many ways, it is the textbook Friday the 13th ripoff. I mean, every early 80s slasher movie looks and feels like this one. And so you almost can't tell it apart. And that becomes its most distinguishing characteristic, its sort of genericness, to the point where the killer, they don't even come up with a fucking costume. It's literally a dude in like a military jacket. No mask, no gimmick. Walks around killing students in a high school.
Well, I was just going to say, they had burned through every holiday because bad producers thought that was
right,
part of the key,
right,
including April Fool's Day. And then they started to cast about, well, what other things can be touchstones of Final Exam, Bat Mitzvah? That seemed to be a trope that existed for no reason.
Yeah.
The Weeknd.
It's slow and pretty dull and totally artless. It was fine at this point in the day.
You're saying it was fine?
It was not. It's not good, but for where I watched it and my state of mind when I watched it, it was fine. Like, I didn't want anything particularly challenging. My head was soup at that point, so I'm happy to have seen it. I don't know how many times I will revisit it, if ever.
And the answer to that is zero, if I could just predict the future. At that point, the masker shows the town the dreaded sundown, and either it was the lateness of the hour or the glaucoma vision print. But I actually think they would have been better served if they had scheduled that at another point in
sure,
the festival. That was a weird...
Originally, it was last.
Well,
they were going to end with that.
Apparently, there were several schedules that some people in the theater were using schedules that weren't up to date.
Hmm.
Because remember, they were going to show The Fog, and then The Fog got bumped for Trick or Treat.
Right.
And then...
Oh, The Fog didn't get shown at all?
Not at all.
Oh, well, that's a bummer.
So then... Well, I was happy about that because I had seen The Fog at Heather's thing, didn't want to repeat.
Yeah.
But, at the ninth hour, in the week running up to the massacre, they were running things on Facebook. Hey... Should we rearrange this for one of your... So that was weird. So some people were not on the same page. But we already talked about Town the Dreaded Sundown.
Right.
And this was a masterstroke. Day of the Dead was a really good choice.
Yeah, you need to end on that.
Yeah, to end on a high note. And I've seen it many times, and I'm aware of its deficiencies, but compared to some of the other things, certainly after Twins of Evil and The Town the Dreaded Sundown, suddenly this is filet mignon. Lori Cardill, she's cuter than a button. I could watch her all day long. And I love the conflict in the film. I love everything in the film. Although today I was struck. At one point, Gary Sklar, who plays the big military guy and does a lot of shows.
Yeah.
He does a lot of shows. There's a scene where the good guys have done something he doesn't like, and he shouts, "You're on my shit list, sister." And if I can indulge in autobiography, my brother-in-law, my wife's brother, used that phrase a lot. He would tell people that they were on his shit list. It was a phrase that he used. And 5 or 6 years ago, my brother-in-law passed away. Very sad, and it was a tragedy, and we miss him. But in going through his things, Jan and I found a piece of paper that was literally his shit list. It wasn't a metaphor.
Right.
At the top, it said, Eddie's shit list. And then there were names of people on the list. And then, most interestingly, there were people that got crossed off. That's and then good. Later re-added to the shit list. And that's one of our best memories, that every so often this comes up, and my wife and I reminisce about the shit list.
Yeah.
In fact, I think at one point I was on the shit list.
Oh, but you got crossed off?
I don't remember.
Oh, dear.
I don't know if we saved it, but I think I wanted to frame it. It was something. Every time I see Day of the Dead, I like it more.
Yes.
Because I'm comparing it less to the first two, and I'm not as disappointed
right.
by what everyone is initially disappointed in that film.
Right. I think it's a movie that has gotten better with age. I think some of Romero's stuff doesn't date particularly well. I think Day of the Dead has actually improved. I think in a lot of ways, it's the one that feels the most like The Walking Dead, and maybe that's just because of Greg Nicotero's involvement.
Well, that's what I was thinking all the way through it.
Yeah.
Halfway through, the helicopter pilot has a long monologue about this place that they're in and how it's sort of a gravestone to the way things used to be. And he has some advice for Lori Cardill about how she should conduct the rest of her life. And it's beautiful. It's Romero at his best. Really getting to what Romero felt those films were.
Yeah.
That he was trying to talk about social things in a way that would be commercial. But there's something so telling and so deep about that monologue. I really liked it a lot.
Yeah. I think it's the best. I'm going to go out on a limb, maybe the best zombie effects ever in a movie. I think still, I don't know that they've ever been surpassed. I just think they're on another level, and just some of the grossest shit you'll ever see. I saw that movie way too young, and watching Rhodes get pulled apart at the end really messed with me and stuck with me my whole life.
That is one of my favorite scenes in any horror film, and not just for the effects, because earlier in the film, the Dr. Frankenstein character has been saying, I removed all of this zombie's organs, and he no longer has a stomach, and yet he still wants to eat. And then 2 minutes later, the zombie turns over on the table, and everything falls out.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's a quantum leap in Gru. as they're pulling Joe Pilato apart, he's shouting choke on it, which... Well, even now, but back when I first saw it, I was like, that's a way to commit to the bit.
And is Day of the Dead where the one where the guy's head gets pulled off and his voice goes up? Or am I confusing that with Dawn of the Dead? There's one where as his vocal cords stretch, you hear the pitch of his voice going up, but it might be Dawn of the Dead. I thought it was Day of the Dead, but...
I'm not sure. As much as I like the film Dawn of the Dead better...
Yes.
A lot of the effects in Dawn of the Dead, although we have... affection for them because they're sort of wood-burned on our brain, come across as looking a little amateurish compared to the stuff in Day of the Dead.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And again, we all sort of lament this idea of, well, here's what Romero wanted to do, and it was this huge epic, and so we know the movie that could have been, and so now we're stuck with this thing where they're just underground and arguing. But again, I have to applaud Romero for saying, I'm going to put it out unrated, and if it's going to be unrated, I only have this amount of money, and so I'll make the movie I can make with this amount of money instead of compromising what he wanted to do to get more financing. I don't know. I really like the movie. I think it's really strong. My last movie, because I too have learned the lesson that you need to end with a bang and not Witchboard 2, The Devil's Doorway. So I watched The Cabin in the Woods, which I realized was my first viewing of The Cabin in the Woods since the first show on the day it opened. I saw it very first show opening day and have not seen it since, which I did not realize.
And Patrick leaves the theater and sends me a now famous text. When school is over, go to this movie. Go right now. Do not read anything about it. Go to it. In fact, I think maybe you sent the text when we got to the boxes. You said when you saw the cells.
Maybe,
when
yeah.
we see what's
yeah.
in all those jail cell-y things, you were like, the JB.
I think I knew to text you at that point. I wasn't texting in the movie. But I'll never be able to have that experience again, knowing nothing about the movie going in. I had avoided it for whatever reason, not even knowing, because I think even the marketing and some of the reviews at the time even hinted at the idea of there's these guys below ground who are running things, and there's these teenagers up here who are sort of...
Spoilers for Cabin.
Yeah, if you guys haven't seen it, get fucking with it. Please.
I have no patience for the meta people who say that the horror part at the beginning is lame. I have no patience for the horror movie people who say that the meta part under the ground is lame. It is a masterpiece. It has so much to say.
Yes.
In a genre that has nothing to say.
Yes.
So we've talked about this before, that we're all chasing the dragon, and horror fans will sit through unredeemable shit, and then this comes out, and people are bad-mouthing it. There's no. This is why we can't have nice things.
My head was spinning the first time I saw it at sort of how cleverly constructed the whole thing is, and not just for the sake of being cleverly constructed, that it very much is both a celebration of and a critique of why we love horror, why we are, where we're at in this genre, what we can do to fix it.
Well, they are us. Right? We are them.
But never says you're wrong for liking horror, or, you know, you're wrong for wanting the teenagers to die. It's saying, no, this is something that we all need to do. This is a necessity since the beginning of time. We have had this thing where we want to see these things played out. Laughing by myself in my basement more than once. The fucking scene, again, major spoilers for Cabin in the Woods coming up, because it was every bit as good as I remembered. The scene where, near the middle to end of the movie, where we cut to Japan and the little girls are exorcising the ghost and putting her spirit inside the happy tree frog.
Yeah.
I was laughing so fucking hard. And then, to make it even funnier, they cut to Richard Jenkins looking at the monitor, yelling, fuck you, to every little girl on the screen. Fuck you, fuck you. He and Bradley Whitford are so funny in that movie. Their comic timing is unbelievable.
Career best performances. It's so clever.
Yes. And needed to end 15 seconds before it ends.
My nitpick, and this seems to be a theme that JB and Patrick think all movies should end a minute before they do, is that if you end with the two of them waiting, then you've come full circle, because you've not only suggested that as human beings we've always wanted to see this, but as human beings we are awaiting
right.
what's beyond the hill, that it would be such a clever, understated depiction of the human condition. It was my same problem with AI, not that I mean to spoil AI, a film that ends five times, but when he's underwater and he's reaching for that thing he can't have, that's where the film ends.
Right.
Because that's where he becomes human, because that's all of us. I've since reconciled myself to the enormous thing that comes out then, and it's fine, and it's more of an exclamation point. But if the film had the balls to just end on the two of them waiting.
And I thought for sure, even the first time I saw it, I thought for sure it was going to cut. Wish we could have seen it. Yeah, that would have been a hell of a weekend or something. Cut to black. Like, yeah, of course. Don't show us the thing. That's brilliant.
And you're reminding me that the last two lines are really final lines.
Right.
That they
right.
work as
right.
as a cut to black.
Yes. So I'm disappointed that the movie goes on those extra, 7 seconds? But that is the definition of a nitpick.
And now JB is wishing that the massacre had ended with The Cabin in the Woods instead of Day of the Dead, although I'm very glad I got to see Day of the Dead again. And now I'm going to go home and go to sleep.
Yeah, now we're done. Another 24 hours in the books. I don't know how many more years we can do this.
Well, we'll talk about that later, but one thing I did want to bring up before we sign off is thank you to all of our listeners, because one of the reasons why I originally got involved in F This Movie is I was feeling sort of alone.
Court ordered. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's my community service. Am I done yet, Your Honor? That I was feeling sort of isolated, at least in terms of movies, and I wanted to have more of a conversation. And F This Movie has certainly afforded that. So thank you for coming along with us on this journey. Really, F This Movie really heats up in October, and it makes us really excited. But you had said this 2 weeks ago, and it stuck with me. And it just came back just now when you said what you said, that we're already thinking about it being over.
Mm-hmm.
Because I used to think at the end of The Massacre that you kind of needed a year, not just to recover, but to get to the point where you really wanted to do it again.
Right.
And that's why having one last weekend and having one this weekend, I can't conceive.
Yeah.
Although I know people who go to both.
Sure.
So happy October.
Bye, everybody. We'll be right back.